This is Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio, a five-part series partnering with the Aspen Ideas Health Conference. All week, we hear conversations with an exceptional mix of inspiring and provocative experts who dive into topics of global and domestic health.
Very often, we assume that individuals that are living in the context of poverty are living in the context of poverty because of mistakes that they've made.
We say the air gets thinner and thinner for women until there's no air left, and that's at the very top.
And in the academic setting, of about 38,000 professors of medicine in the country, there's only 10 of us who are American Indian.
You have a small child, and you know there's a treatment that could completely help them, and as a hospital, you're giving them a subpar treatment.
I'm Allison Vektesh. Today we look at health, wealth, and the ethics and values of medicine. How can we ensure that everyone has access to care, even if they can't afford it? And how can we improve healthcare or continue researching it if it isn't profitable? When is it right to raise prices on drugs? What are we saying we value when we make policy decisions about health and healthcare? And even if we perfect the system, what does it matter if the majority of the population has no way to access it? Coming up, we turn to Aspen Ideas Health speakers for the answers. Thanks for tuning in to Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio. Stay tuned. Edna Masiwa is the executive director of the Women's Action Group, a nonprofit in Zimbabwe that supports rural women and families living with HIV. Prior to this work, she was a nurse in a labor ward. The hospital wasn't able to take care of all its patients. Women and their newborns were put on the floor because there were not enough beds. And conditions were getting worse.
I left Harare Hospital in 92, and that was the year when things started to deteriorate drastically in the health centers. For the first time, we heard that people, sometimes there was no food in the hospitals.
Her new line of work focuses on health delivery services. She travels to rural communities throughout Zimbabwe. The doctor-patient relationship is an imbalance of power everywhere. But Zimbabwe's own Ministry of Health created a patient's rights charter to help even the scales.
This is a charter that has been developed by Zimbabwe to outline the patient's rights when they go to the hospital. Before, the system was such that the nurse knew more than the patient. But for us, we wanted the patient to be well informed for them to be able to demand the services from the health centers. So our work focused mainly on pushing for self-value for patients, that when they get to the hospital, it's not like the health workers are doing them a favor. It's their right to access the health services.
If there was one of those word bubble charts that showed all the terms that came up while talking to the Aspen Ideas Health speakers, the kind where the more a word is said, the bigger font it appears in, right smack dab in the middle, overshadowing all else, would be the word access.
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 It comes up in every conversation because all research, all the technology, all the solutions, all the medical miracles, what does it matter if you can't get unhealthy people healthy? Dawn Legans is an expert in residence at the design and innovation firm IDEO. She separates the term health and health care. She agrees there's an access problem to both.
There's also an equity issue in health, healthcare for sure, but before we, the reason so many people who are low income and who have had less access to the care system, right, start off living in grocery deserts, healthy grocery deserts. They end up being in places where there's much more pollution and things that are causing asthma and other conditions. There's, as we said, much less access, more waiting, tools that aren't designed or marketed to them. So that there's a lot of things that could contribute to health that people are not able to equally access. And then that leads to the need for healthcare, which they, again, can't equally access.
Sometimes when we're talking about access, we mean proximity. Masiwa, for instance, deals with patients who travel for hours via public transportation when they're sick.
Because we have the primary health care, it's supposed to be less than 5 kilometers away, but we have people walking or getting on buses to go 20 kilometers from where they live.
But for many, access isn't so much about proximity as it is about finances. Healthcare is expensive. Healthcare is expensive when you're healthy and just paying a monthly premium to make sure you have insurance that could help out in a catastrophic event. And when you aren't healthy, well, the bills rise from there. Nora McInerney and her then-boyfriend Aaron had just moved in together. They were in their late 20s, both working professionals from middle-class backgrounds. He had a seizure one day and was rushed to the hospital.
They told us that night that he had a brain tumor, and he was admitted to the hospital, and we laid there. And one of the first things he said to me was, "How will I pay for this?" Not, "Oh God, I hope I don't die." Not, "Oh God, they're going to saw my head open in 4 days." How will I pay for this?
McInerney now hosts the podcast, Terrible, Thanks for Asking, sprung from this sudden seizure to cancer treatments to eventually losing Aaron. Often it is made all too clear, a little too late, how complicated the healthcare system is. As she puts it, you don't know until you're the one at the front row of the funeral.
Because everybody gets to the front row at the funeral eventually, right?
For many, grieving the loss of a loved one also involves a haunting from the bills that have piled up and continue to come. Even dying is expensive.
What I think about constantly is the fact that our healthcare system is so unfair, is so broken, and that the things that can kill you will first destroy you financially, and then they'll destroy your family's finances, and they will leave a trail of destruction from which your family may or may not ever recover. So my experience with the healthcare system is that I cannot look at it without a lot of resentment. And that resentment comes from the fact that it has been commoditized, that there are companies that make a lot of money on people's illnesses, and that things that should be a pretty basic human right are not at all.
Nasha Fitter is the co-founder of FOXG1 Research Foundation. FOXG1 is a rare neurological condition, but she didn't know that when she first heard the term. Doctors told her that's what was causing her 3-year-old daughter, Amara, to have seizures.
I didn't even know how to react to it. And then I finally started looking online and researching it. And at that time, there was barely anything known about it. So I went on the NIH site. And I still remember the words that stood out to me where it said, you know, severe intellectual disabilities, lack of speech, lack of movement. Well, that was the day that I completely broke down. For weeks, I would sit in a room in my closet. I'd shut the door and it was dark. And I would just sit there and I would just let the grief just be inside me. To think that your child is going to have severe intellectual disabilities, to think that your child is never going to speak. I mean, these are the things that it's really difficult to explain. It was just soul crushing for me.
There was a turning point when she thought she could either keep wallowing or take action. She wrote to scientists around the world whose work related to FOXG1 and asked them, if you had the money, what would you do? And that led to the Research Foundation. She knows that's not a question or a quest that most parents can take on.
We were lucky that we were near Stanford and UCSF, and so I think we had access to some of the best medical care, and we had doctors that really went out of their way to help. And what I've learned through my experience with working with so many other parents around the world is that is 100% not the case in most places.
She's watched as children have undergone needless and invasive medical interventions, and she knows hospitals lacking resources is the norm.
So there's parents who have had their children undergo surgeries, brain surgeries, when they were not needed, for example, and they have like life-altering consequences. There's parents who, you know, something simple like ACTH is a medication used to treat infantile spasms, seizures that affect children under the age of 2. It is one of the most expensive medications out there. So the majority of hospitals in the world do not carry it. And when you just think of like, I cannot even imagine, you have a small child and you know there's a treatment that could completely help them. And as a hospital, you're giving them a subpar treatment that is likely not going to help. I mean, that happens all the time, right? And it's just, so when we think about ethics, I think just the fact that we know that there's treatments that are more helpful, especially for babies and for small children, and we as a nation, you know, make it impossible for hospitals to access those treatments or too expensive and most insurance companies don't cover it, I think there's something really, really wrong there.
You are listening to Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio, exploring our global healthcare system through the research and insights of the speakers of the Aspen Ideas Health Conference, produced by the Aspen Institute. Today, we are exploring the tracks Health and Wealth and Ethics, Values, and Health. Stay with us. Emergency room doctor Ali Raja has found himself becoming patients' first point of contact.
Without the right healthcare plan, especially given the lack of insurance in a lot of places, as well as the high deductible plans that many people have been taking on over the past few years, it's really hard to get primary care and specialist access if you don't have the right plans. And so, for example, right now, I see plenty of patients who come into my emergency department simply for primary care.
Part of the issue is about practical life and scheduling and working around work.
Primary care doesn't make a lot of money. They're pediatricians' offices. They can't stay open late into the evening. They can't stay open on weekends. And so rather than forcing a single parent household to take time off work, to take their children out of school, to try to arrange for everything around their lives to get their kids to their pediatrician for their annual checkup on a Tuesday afternoon, which is the only time the pediatrician is open. Instead, they come in overnight or on the weekend to my emergency department to get much of the care that they could have gotten at their pediatrician's office.
But mostly it's about economics. It's not lucrative to be a primary health provider to all who need it.
If it's based on profit, we don't have equitable access to healthcare. We pay for procedures. We pay for treatments. And a lot of primary care is not a procedure, and it's not a treatment. It's prevention. It's making sure that we catch things early. It's running blood tests just to make sure that they're normal every year and picking up something before you get drastically ill. Whereas, and don't get me wrong, some of my good friends are dermatologists. Whereas in dermatology, if you remove a lesion, you get paid for it. If you start a college student on Accutane, you get paid for it. And so there's a differential in the reimbursement for what we're willing to support and pay for as a healthcare system that isn't equitable and doesn't help primary care.
So there's a connection between poverty and access. Things are expensive. Rich people have the ability to pay, poor people don't. Maybe that's just the way it goes. If you're poor, you don't get as much, just like any other commodity. And that's where we get into ethics. Who gets to be healthy? Who gets to decide? When these decisions are being made on the federal level through public policy, a nation's values tend to show through pretty clearly. Crystal Hall is an associate professor at the Evans School of Public Policy and Governance at the University of Washington.
There are attitudes that people have about what people deserve and what people might not deserve. And very often we assume that individuals that are living in the context of poverty are living in the context of poverty because of mistakes that they've made or their own shortcomings. As a psychologist, I like to think about what are the similarities between people that are more or less disadvantaged and how can that help us understand the way that they interact with public policies, rather than assuming that people are in certain positions because of something that's inherent to their personality.
Hall is also a social psychologist. She looks at people's decision-making processes, why they make the choices they do, how they form habits, and importantly, how the stigmas and narratives around who they are within society influence all of that.
Often, the constraints that we face in the moment, going back to this idea of scarcity, have an impact on our decision-making. So maybe I intend to make a healthier choice in terms of what I eat, but in my neighborhood, I don't have close access to a grocery store, or the store that I do have access to doesn't have as much fresh produce. And we know that individuals are so influenced by just the day-to-day constraints that we all face, where we need to make it easy for people to make healthy choices. We need to make it easy for people to reach the goals that they have for themselves, because all of us, not just people that are experiencing poverty, all of us are so heavily influenced by some of those behavioral constraints that we face just from not having enough time or from being stressed out or many of the social and contextual factors that we all face on a day-to-day basis.
The speakers of the Aspen Ideas Health Festival are also looking at ways to increase access to the healthcare sector, not for patients, but for doctors. Esther Chu is among 50 female healthcare professionals who just this spring launched Time's Up Healthcare, a branch of the Time's Up movement, bringing to light sexual harassment and inequities within the workplace. Healthcare is the fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy. Over 18 million people work in the industry, 80% of them are women.
It's an unnatural power dynamic where every time you pull up a website about a healthcare system, you can see it played out over and over again. There are many women there. We're doing the day-to-day work. And then the further up you go, we say the air gets thinner and thinner for women until there's no air left, and that's at the very top. It's very unusual to see a female CEO, a female board of directors, a female on the board of directors. The executive leadership tends not to be very diverse in terms of gender or race and ethnicity or other factors.
Chu says the healthcare industry is so traditional or slow to change that increasing access to the medical field for women is going to take a long process of many victories.
And so it's a balance for us in Times Up Healthcare to really try to be innovative enough that we can feel the change within our lifetimes, you know? I mean, I look to my kids and I want them to walk into a different workplace if they are to choose to go into healthcare. But at the same time, we have to have doors open to us in the hallowed halls of medicine, you know, and across healthcare. These traditional structures need to let us in. And so we need to speak their language and also be collaborative and positive. I honestly think it doesn't sound like a radical goal and probably not as innovative as and edgy as I'd like to sound, but our first year goal is simply getting the major healthcare systems to sign on to Time's Up Healthcare's basic principles. And those are that sexual harassment and discrimination have no place in the healthcare workforce, that women should have equal opportunity and compensation, and that we have to measure the problems of harassment and inequity, otherwise we cannot solve them. Those sound so basic, and yet we do not act like we believe in them. We do not behave like these things are true.
Emergency room doctor Ali Raja is the executive vice chairman in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital and an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. He expresses a similar sentiment and says behaviors will not change on their own.
We're seeing more women go into the field. Diversity is such a large word. We're definitely seeing more women go into medicine. More than half of medical students are women. What we aren't seeing is we aren't seeing women in leadership positions the way that it should be. And so there is still a ceiling. There is still an old boys club. And there is still an inequity of women in leadership positions in healthcare. That's changing, but it's changing because of the work of men and women who are focused on it. It's not something that'll naturally change.
Of course, to diversify the medical profession, we first need to diversify medical education. Don Warren is an Oglala Lakota and Associate Dean for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the School of Medicine and Health Sciences at the University of North Dakota.
Around the nation, when you look at all of the medical schools, there are zero American Indian deans of a medical school. And that really is a shame. I mean, what an indictment on the lack of inclusion. And there are three of us around the country that serve as associate deans. And in the academic setting, of about 38,000 professors of medicine in the country, 38,000 of them, there's only 10 of us who are American Indian. 10 out of 38,000.
In the fall of 2020, UND will, for the first time, be launching a PhD in Indigenous Health, The specialization will allow medical students to learn and address commonalities experienced by Indigenous populations worldwide.
So whether it's American Indian, Alaska Native, First Nations in Canada, Aboriginal Australians, Pacific Islanders, Maoris from New Zealand, there's a lot of commonalities in terms of the impact of colonization, the loss of traditional health systems, traditional food systems, and self-sufficiency. And because of colonization, we see some very common outcomes, like higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of mental health and behavioral health conditions, and substance abuse and suicide, and all of these terrible outcomes that have a common root focused on the impact of colonization and resulting marginalization and loss of resources and loss of access to traditional healthier ways of life.
The degree will have a research track and a professional track, which is a big deal. American Indians are more likely to return to their home communities.
That's just across all races and ethnicities, to be quite honest, that American Indian physicians have a greater tendency to work with American Indian populations. Same is true for African American, Hispanic, and other populations. So just understanding the patterns of where people work based on race and ethnicity has a huge impact on society and whether or not we have access and equitable access to health services.
Which is needed. When Warren was working as a local physician, he was frustrated time and time again with the lack of access his patients were given to address their basic healthcare needs.
But one of my big frustrations, primarily working within Indian Health Service and related programs, is that we don't have access to the same tools that providers have access to in the private sector. So I could recognize that the patient in front of me needed a particular referral or needed a particular medication, but because of underfunding of our health system, we just simply didn't have access to it. So very direct inequity based on access to medical services. The majority of the health ailments I was dealing with in the primary care setting were preventable. So for example, type 2 diabetes, that is preventable, but we're not going to prevent diabetes in the hospital. It really has to be done in the communities. And there's the social and policy factors that influence diabetes incidence are not going to be resolved in the clinic. We're not going to prescribe our way out of it. It's wonderful to have an impact one patient at a time. That's really valuable, and it's an honor to do that work. But I was very frustrated, to be honest, because I felt like there were tools available that we just didn't have access to.
So if there's hospitals out there that can't get access to specialized seizure medication for infants, and primary care doctors working for the government feel left in the dust without the pills and procedures they know their patients need, I mean, these are trained people in the profession. How are just normal people supposed to keep up? Ollie Rogers says, for one, take healthcare to the people.
For example, Walmart a few years ago started putting optometrists inside Walmart, and we found that people were able to get glasses because they were already going to Walmart anyway. And if we took pediatricians' offices and put them into schools, for example, especially in low-income neighborhoods, or linked them right next door to the school so the parent didn't have to come all the way over, take a day off work, and take their kid to the pediatrician, but instead the school nurse could just grab them from the school, take them over to the pediatrician office, and have that taken care of, we'd make it so much easier for working parents, especially single-parent households, to be able to take care of their children the way that they should.
This is true of all our public environments. Crystal Hall is a social psychologist and an associate professor at the Evans School of Public Policy and Governance at the University of Washington. She says our places of business, banking, and health are not all that representative.
As a separate example, when folks are engaging in financial decisions and people's decisions to engage in formal versus informal or different types of banking products or services. So specifically, I'm thinking about someone that may feel not comfortable going into a bank. We talk a lot about how low-income individuals are not comfortable using banks. And I think there's a lot of reasons why that might be the case. Whereas perhaps a check cashier might be an environment where they feel more comfortable and they may not be as directly faced with their with the stigma that has to go along with their identity. And that can be about the way that the bank teller talks to them. That can be about the way that maybe the security guard looks at them. And I think you can think about that also with respect to health behaviors as well, and decisions that people make about where they buy food or where they seek out healthcare. And the fact that I think there's a long way we can go to making those environments comfortable for the people that are facing the most stigma, and recognizing the fact that that stigma can have an impact on many different types of the decisions that they make.
Tweaking our public health spheres to be more inclusive means understanding the social environments of your patients, which probably means understanding it because you know it, which means widening the conversation, so that the future of our healthcare solutions aren't the brainstorm of just a single race and gender, making presumptions about our entire population. Hall gives the example of the growing government requirements of posting calorie counts at chain fast food restaurants.
What I think we don't understand is what are the right structures to encourage these types of healthy behaviors, because it can be very easy to assume that people will make the decisions that they need to make to stay on the pathway to health, for example. And it can be really easy to underestimate the impact of so many different societal factors. And there's a lot of interesting research emerging out of the fields of psychology and behavioral science that are helping us think about how different policies and practices sometimes don't have the effects that we expect them to have. And so the stigma of obesity, for example, is something that I think we're just starting to understand. I think we don't really understand at a deep level what is the impact that labeling food calorie counts has on decision making. I think the evidence in that space has been really mixed, and I think that there's a lot of work to be done in understanding what is the psychological impact on someone who is probably already very aware of their stigma that goes along with being obese, for example, and what's the impact of being faced in a public space with calorie counts on food? How does that change your public behavior in a space where other people can see your behavior? How does that change your private behavior when maybe that behavior isn't as public? And I think there's a lot that we don't understand yet. And there are a lot of assumptions that we make that I think psychology has the tools for us to unpack a little bit more deeply. And from a policy perspective, that's so important, because psychology can really allow us to build particular types of evidence to understand what some of the impacts might be. Or, you know, when we implement a policy like calorie labeling, and, you know, maybe the evidence comes out mixed as to whether it changed behavior, I think a psychological approach can help us ask the questions that we need to ask to really understand that at a deeper level.
Adding more seats to the table of public policy and healthcare on the next episode of Aspen Ideas Health. From fast food to slow change, and exploring access to health, healthcare, and health education, the speakers of the Aspen Ideas Health Conference are taking on these questions firsthand. Join us all week as we dig into the ethics and values of our healthcare system, learn more about patient-centered care, take a frank look at mental health, and come to terms with aging. I'm Allison Bektesh. You've been listening to Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio, in partnership with the Aspen Ideas Health Conference, produced by the Aspen Institute, running in Aspen June 20th through June 23rd. Join us each day this week at 3:30 for conversations with featured speakers from the 2019 festival. Thanks for listening. To your health.